More local lawsuits filed against Monsanto. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, we'll tell you why local cancer patients say the makers of Roundup cause their disease. Have you used Roundup? What are your questions about this? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the future of transportation here on the First Coast, how you can be part of that conversation. All of that and more ahead. But first this morning, more local residents are filing lawsuits against Monsanto, the makers of Roundup. It's the world's most popular weed killer. They say Roundup caused their non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Now, the big issue is Roundup's main ingredient, glyphosate, and it has been linked to cancer. Attorney Chris Shahib of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm says Monsanto knew the glyphosate was likely carcinogenic for decades, but that they deceived scientists and the public into believing it was safe. He's representing eight local consumers who say Roundup gave them cancer, and he joins us now in studio. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. What are your questions about the new lawsuits against Roundup coming from local cancer patients? Do you have Roundup in your garage? Most people do. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect, wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So tell us about some of your clients. How did they get cancer, do they think?
Well, you know, I'll give you a little synopsis of a couple. One was a coach, a soccer coach who used it in his yard and took great pride in his lawn, and he used it for decades, spraying weeds in his lawn. And he had an acre of property, devoted husband, you know, attended church and participated in their youth programs. And then just some routine lab work showed that he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He went through rounds of chemo, and he unfortunately lost his life.
So he is similar in the way he presented to some of your other clients. Did they all use Roundup just in their lawns as a way to control weeds?
Right. The majority of my clients were people who just on a regular basis used Roundup, maybe once a week, once, twice a month, but on a regular basis. You know, Florida, unlike other parts of the country, you know, we're weeding all year round. And so we're particularly vulnerable here compared to other places. And it's the long-term repeated use, which is the greatest indicator of getting this.
And how do we know that? What made these folks and you link the use of Roundup to their non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
So the main thing, what really started the litigation was in March of 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, or the AIRC, which is part of the World Health Organization, classified glyphosate, again, the main ingredient in Roundup, as probably carcinogenic to humans. And they said that there is strong evidence that exposure to glyphosate is genotoxic. Genotoxic means it can cause damage to the DNA, which is a precursor to developing cancer.
Right.
And once that came out, that's really when people started looking at it, and the lawsuits were filed about a year later.
There are more than 20,000 claims now against Monsanto, including your clients. How did all of this get started? This is a worldwide litigation against this company over this product now, correct?
Yeah. You know, what happened was when that came out, lawsuits were filed, and there was discovery that was conducted in those lawsuits. And a lot of information came out, information that was really surprising, such as in the late 90s, Monsanto, the company that makes Roundup, had hired a internationally renowned scientist to really do some research to show how safe Roundup is. And he did that research and decided, told them, we've got a problem, that it appears to be genotoxic, and we need to do more studies and we need to get the word out. And what happened after that is Monsanto buried that report, didn't publish it, didn't release it to the EPA or any other regulatory agencies. They just let that disappear.
We should point out that Monsanto has denied wrongdoing and has stood by their product. As they've been asked about this, as the lawsuits pile up, we want your calls. Do you use Roundup to kill weeds in your yard? Are you concerned at all about this product and whether it's safe? Let us know your thoughts about this at 549-2937. And Chris, this gets into a bigger issue that is more of a cultural issue. If it appears that some people have been poisoned by this product, potentially, this speaks to our obsession in America with lawns, with having a perfect weed-free lawn and putting a bunch of chemicals on it to make sure it looks a certain way, to the point where, allegedly, we are getting sick because of it. What about that?
Well, look, I'm as guilty as the next person. I like to have a nice lawn. It's what we tend to do, particularly in Jacksonville. But it has changed the way that I manage my lawn. I don't use Roundup. I used to years ago, and I think a lot more about, you know, how we're controlling weeds, and I'm not using chemicals anymore. I spend a lot of time out in my yard weeding by hand, that it's not easy. But
yeah, it's a lot more work. Roundup is convenient. Just squirt it at the weed and it's taken care of.
It would be so nice just to have something like that. But, all the clients I've talked to and the times that, you know, the described going through chemotherapy, I think I'd rather be bending down in the yard, pulling weeds than going through chemotherapy.
Certainly, too, there's been a bit of a movement in this state and in other states to get away from lots of chemicals on your lawn, to encourage the use of native plants or even xeriscaping. It's now legal for you to dispute your homeowners association insisting that you have to have a lawn that looks the traditional way. Some homeowners have gone to court to battle that. That's another sort of related issue. But getting back to Roundup, you know, going beyond the way the average consumer uses it, Roundup really took hold, you say, agriculturally,
right,
and became ubiquitous that way. And so not only is it going onto our lawns, it's going into our food products as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In the late 90s, Monsanto developed genetically modified seeds that were resistant to Roundup. Roundup is a broad spectrum herbicide that typically kills everything. But these seeds were resistant, and it became very popular. It changed agriculture. It is now in 94% of our soybean crops, 90% of our cotton and corn crops. Roundup is used on 100 different types of crops, and then it's registered in 130 countries. It's everywhere. The top way that Monsanto makes money off of Roundup. It's not really the gardening use that is the number one moneymaker for them.
It's big agriculture.
It's very big money.
Okay. So why then, if this product has been flagged by so many lawsuits, why then is it still being marketed to consumers without any kind of warning label? And what is the EPA's role in all of those?
Well, you know, it's funny. In 1985, the EPA, our Environmental Protection Agency, actually had classified glyphosate as a possible carcinogen. But that changed in 91. They said there was evidence of non-carcinogenicity for humans. And then 2016, they said it's not likely to be carcinogenic. In 2019, just this past August, there was a proposed label change saying that it could potentially be carcinogenic. And the EPA refused to do that. They said that the claims that it causes cancer are false claims. So the EPA has essentially been in the tank for Monsanto at least since 1985.
They deny that. The EPA has disputed this characterization of their agency.
Yes, and it, you know, the studies that they used, particularly for 2016, if you dig down into how they viewed Roundup and glyphosate, the studies that they based their decisions on were actually generated by Monsanto. And they were pretty selective studies, and they didn't take into account, you know, how Monsanto is, formulates glyphosate into Roundup with other products, which can actually make the glyphosate more dangerous to humans. They didn't do any of that. And so the studies that they were basing their decisions on were, you know, one-sided industry studies.
And it's 549-2937. As we talk about a new round of local lawsuits against Monsanto, local patients say the weed killer Roundup, they believe, caused their cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Do you use Roundup? What are your questions about this and why there are no warning labels on this product? It's 549-2937. Tracy is in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy. Good morning. Hey, Tracy, you're on the air. Okay, I don't know why we're not hearing her, but what she wanted to ask you, Chris, is that she used Roundup heavily, she says, on a small parcel of land she owned. How long should she wait, she says, to check and see if she's in trouble?
Well, I would recommend that anybody that's concerned about it, if you're having any of the symptoms for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, then you should see your doctor. And
what are the symptoms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
So the starting point would be painless, swelling lymph nodes in the neck, armpits, or the groin, abdominal pain and swelling, chest pain, fatigue, fever, night sweats, unexplained weight loss, easy bruising and bleeding, and severe and frequent infections.
Your clients all had these symptoms?
Yes, in different levels. The thing about it is that which symptoms a person will get and how severe they are really varies. A lot of my clients, the diagnosis came just as a matter of coincidence or luck.
Interesting. And it's fascinating to me that you believe and they believe just holding a little bottle of Roundup with the little squirter and pointing it downward away from yourself at the ground, at the weed, that's enough exposure, you say, to cause this kind of cancer.
So there have been three cases that went to trial with very large verdicts. One of them was Dwayne Lee Johnson, who was a 46-year-old school groundskeeper. When he used Roundup to spray the school's grounds, not only was he just spraying it, he was wearing protective clothing. And even that use caused him to develop non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
All right, let's go to some more calls now. It's 549-2937 as we talk about lawsuits, local lawsuits against Monsanto, the makers of Roundup. Cindy is on the line. She's traveling along JTB this morning. Hey, Cindy, good morning.
Hi. I'm calling in because I know the guy that worked on the development of Roundup and took it to market.
Really?
And then went on to genetically engineered seeds, plants, what have you. And still, after all this time, doesn't care.
Who is this person?
And I think it's a... it could be a cultural issue within Monsanto. He no longer works there, but it's kind of alarming to think that somebody was paid to do all this and has never looked back.
And you know him and you've confronted him about this and he said he didn't feel that it was a problem. Is that what you're saying?
I haven't confronted him as much as I know. He doesn't live in Florida, so I can't do that. And but I know this, and there's just absolutely no remorse, no apologies, nothing.
And how did you react to that?
Boy, I guess there was a sense of despair that people who knew about all this didn't do anything, didn't say anything, just kept bringing in the bucks. And so that was very disheartening.
Well, Cindy, I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling. You know, Chris, if these allegations prove out and these lawsuits are successful, it brings to mind the specter we saw of so many people suffering and dying due to their use of tobacco.
Yes.
And if her allegations are correct, the tobacco giant executives saying that they had no idea that their product was carcinogenic when documents later revealed that they did, in fact, know for many decades that it was.
In the litigation that's been going on and through the discovery process, they've found emails, you know, from decades showing that, you know, Monsanto had a lot greater knowledge about the carcinogenicity of glyphosate and that they've been holding that back for years. We know that now.
My colleague Brendan Rivers, who covers environmental issues, just tweeted me. He said, please point out that researchers also believe Roundup may be responsible for declines in the monarch butterfly population. So that's not part of your litigation. However, there have been allegations this product is damaging our ecosystem as well as human beings.
Right. There was a good article about the use of Roundup agriculturally in the New York Times over the weekend. Farmers have become very dependent on Roundup, where they use one single item. And at first, it actually was better than a lot of other things that were available. The problem is there always tends to be unintended consequences, when you introduce something like this. And now resistant weeds are developing. There's 24 of them worldwide. 14 of them are in the U.S. alone. And these weeds don't die with Roundup or anything else. And that's one thing that is happening. And then, you know, the other potential things are other animals that are affected beyond just humans. I think anytime you get too dependent on one product, it creates potential problems down the road.
Let's try Tracy in Mandarin again. Hey, Tracy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
About a couple of years ago, we have one-eighth an acre or one-fourth of an acre land, and me and my husband, we sprayed very heavily with Roundup, and I remember getting sprayed on the feet and on the arms. My question is, how long I should live in fear or no fear? I have no complaint, no lymph node, no nothing. Blood count done so often is fine. And how long I should be say, well, I am in a safe zone after so many years. But then question on the side is, everybody know vaping is killing so many. Why can't anything be done in Florida to ban it 100%? I will take myself off the air. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for that.
Well, Tracy, regarding banning, that would be something that would have to be done at the federal level. And not only is the EPA not banning Roundup, they're refusing to even say that it's dangerous. So I think we have a long way to go with seeing a ban on Roundup.
What should consume? And there's not even a warning label.
There's not even a.
Do you think there should be? What would you tell consumers out there?
Right. I mean, I'll give you an example. Artificial sweeteners are out there, and if you look at them, they're cancer warnings, and those have been there, particularly for the pink one, for decades. People still buy those products, but they choose, am I willing to take this risk? And at the very least, that should be present for Roundup.
We're getting messages on our Facebook page, one from Rosemarie. She writes, I use a steam mop to kill weeds in my pavers, gone without any Roundup. Mark out at Mayport emails the show from Mayport Naval Station. This is what I use for weed and grass control. Salt, vinegar, and a little dish soap. Since I live on the river, I'm conscious about what I put on the ground. Thanks for that, Mark. And it's 549-2937. Local cancer patients are suing Monsanto in a group. They are the makers of Roundup. It's the nation's top weed killer, but thousands of lawsuits allege that a chemical in Roundup has caused non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in many Americans. What do you think about this? 549-2937. Carlos is on the west side. Hi, Carlos. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question or a comment. Many years ago, I bought the yellow bottle of this Roundup, but I have never used it. My concern is, how do I properly dispose of this? I don't want to put it out on the street for the garbage collection people to pick it up. I imagine that that would affect them. So my concern is primarily how to safely get rid of this bottle of Roundup.
That's a good question too, Carlos. Thanks for that. Yeah, what if you have it in your garage, you're listening to this, and you think, okay, I don't want to use this anymore. What do I do with this bottle?
So this question comes up for my clients. Unfortunately for my clients, what I want them to do is save it because it's evidence. But for those of you who fortunately don't have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or not in litigation, what I recommend is that you call the city of Jacksonville to get information on they have a facility for disposing of potentially toxic or dangerous chemicals and things, TVs, and and they can tell you where to go there, how to get there and how to dispose of it. That's the best way to do it. I don't recommend just putting it in your garbage.
Don't just throw it out in the garbage. Yeah. And that goes for any other kind of toxic chemical that you have, even old batteries, things like that. There are ways to dispose of that stuff.
Right. Putting it in the garbage, creates problems down the road for everybody.
Okay. So you have 8 clients now locally. Do you anticipate more?
Yeah, I have 8 clients. I expect that by the end of the month, I'll have 15 or even more. I'm meeting with new clients pretty regularly on this.
And to be clear, this isn't a class action lawsuit.
It is not. Everybody has their own individual case. They're being litigated together, but when there are trials, the trials are individual.
So as Monsanto faces all of this litigation, thousands of people all over the country, they have not banded together in a class action. Is that right? Why not?
Well, when people are injured, it's actually everybody's injuries are a little bit different. And so you don't actually have a class action for personal injuries like this. So instead of a class action, we call them mass torts. We have that. And so people are banded together. The litigation has gone really well. There have been 3 verdicts so far, the verdict was for $2,055,000,000.
And how has that been paid out to consumers?
No, the judge reduced it. All 3 of the awards, which were massive, were reduced, but still to very large judgments. $78.5 million, $23.3 million. 86.7 million.
And that money was divided among how many people?
Just the individual plaintiffs.
Just 3 individual plaintiffs.
Right. Now, Monsanto has appealed, and the federal judge in charge of the majority of the litigation has ordered the parties into mediation. And, because of the pressure on Bayer, which now owns Monsanto, there's a good chance that in the very near future, there will be a settlement. But that's why it's important that if you have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and it may be related to Monsanto's Roundup products, that you do something about it.
You believe time is of the essence.
It's going to be important that if you have a claim, that you get your claim in sooner than later, particularly if the settlement occurs you know, soon, which I think there's a good chance it will.
Let's take some more calls now as we talk about local lawsuits against Monsanto, the makers of Roundup. It's 549-2937. Gretchen is in Nocatee. Hi, Gretchen. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. My question is, I have two family members that one is thankfully in remission with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma type B, and the other is her cousin, younger cousin, who actually was diagnosed recently with that. And I do not know if she ever used Roundup, but my mother-in-law was in the garden club and did use Roundup quite frequently. And my question is actually connected to it, but I do wonder, my son-in-law is in the health profession, and he has mentioned that there is a study out. Scientists are now looking at toxins such as Roundup in the ground that may be causing a rise in autism. And I just wanted to know what you have to say, your guest has to say about that possibility.
Thanks for that. Yeah, I hadn't realized there might be a linkage. Certainly, there's been no shortage of theories as to what is causing the uptick in autism in kids. But what about that?
Right now, there's no good science, peer-reviewed science that suggests there's a connection there. I mean, we don't know what we don't know. That could be developed later. But right now, I haven't seen anything that really links those two things.
For parents out there, though, certainly it's a concern. You're wondering, even if it's not Roundup, chemicals that are omnipresent in our environment, in our food, in the air we breathe, it's scary for parents who want to protect their children from dangerous chemicals, which are, as you say, not being appropriately regulated.
Right. It's... You know, in 1996, the Attorney General of New York actually prosecuted Monsanto for false advertising in relation to Roundup. The ads they were running showed, you know, that they said Roundup is safe for your kids to play in, even, and or it's as safe as, you know, ingesting table salt, things that they had to admit were not correct, and they had to agree to stop running those ads, but it was the state of New York, so they only stopped running those ads in the state of New York. They ran everywhere else for years, and they weren't true.
So tell me a little bit more then about how Roundup is marketed today.
So Roundup is marketed to individuals, consumers who use it in their yards with heavy TV and print advertising. Everybody's seen those ads over the years. For farmers, it's marketed with the seeds that that they use, the genetically modified seeds that are resistant to Roundup. It's a kind of a 1-2 punch for farmers that in the short term saves them a lot of money. In the long term, I think will be problematic because of the unintended consequences of using just one product as your whole solution to weeds.
Nathan is on the line from Springfield. He is known as the man in overalls. He helps people plant beautiful flowers and native plants in their yards and grow produce. Hey, Nathan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Good deal. Yeah, so for years I have been amending my diet to avoid Roundup residues on food because it makes me very ill and spend a lot of time in the bathroom. And in light of that, I've done a lot of digging and found that a whole host of GI issues are highly correlated with the rates of Roundup use over the years that skyrocketed when Roundup Ready crops were released. And I wonder who are the trial lawyers in Florida that are putting together the public health case. What I've seen are numbers that the public health implications have a potential payout that's about 4 times out of tobacco. And I'm ready for it to happen because I'm tired of having to avoid, 2/3 of American food. I just want to be able to eat food that's grown here. So
do you just always buy organic produce, Nathan? How do you deal with it?
I avoid any conventionally grown crops that could be Roundup ready. And increasingly, I have to avoid things like wheat and sugar and oats because they're all being Roundup is advocated as a harvest aid, quote, that speeds up the harvest time for those crops. So I have to avoid that. I grow a lot of my own produce, but it's a lot of the grain type foods. And then soybean oil, because that's a Roundup Ready crop. Sugar is increasingly sugar beets, which are Roundup Ready. And
all kinds of products, millions of us eat every day. In other words,
absolutely.
Well, Nathan, thanks for that. That's the man in overalls calling in from Springfield. He's a great guy. And, you know, Chris, this, it goes beyond whether you used it on your yard, as we've been saying. It's in our food supply. And there's really no way to know. There's no labeling at the store. You don't really know whether the foods you're eating have this chemical trace and whether or not that's affecting our health. We don't know.
Right.
The Although he believes certainly it's affecting his health.
Right. The only way that you can be pretty sure you're not getting Roundup in your food is to eat food that's labeled non-GMO. Because if it's Roundup Ready, it's a GMO product. So that would be one way to avoid it. The science is not great yet about the effects of Roundup in the food, in our food system. But, you know, as the science progresses, I expect they'll, if the science supports it, there'll be more litigation. And certainly people like myself will be filing these lawsuits. But right now, the evidence is much stronger for the inhalation of Roundup.
In the meantime, we want to direct folks that have any more questions and weren't able to call in to go to the website terrellhogan.com. Full disclosure, they are an underwriter at WJCT. Attorney Chris Shakib, a pleasure. Thanks for educating all of us about these lawsuits.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Still to come, a preview of 96 Hours of Anguish, a raw look at the destruction Hurricane Dorian caused in the Bahamas. Airing on local TV tonight, and also how you can be part of the big conversation about the future of transportation here on the First Coast. We'll be right back.
Our community has seen and experienced so much growth over the last few years. WJCT is growing too. WJCT brings you All Things Considered and other national programs, along with local programs like First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross. You're part of this community, the public radio community. Call now to support your WJCT. Call 904-353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at WJCT.org and give what you can. We're trying to reach $80,000 over the next week. We're at about $7,000 right now. We need your help to get to that $80,000 mark. And to thank you, we are giving away an Echo Dot a day. Every amount submitted will get you into a raffle drawing for that Echo Dot every single day you give. You can give $1, you can give $100, you can give $80,000. You might have a chance to get that Echo Dot. We've also got a metal travel straw to help you save the environment as you support WJCT. And we have a tote bag. Both of those things say WJCT on them. They are our way of thanking you for your support and letting you show everybody that you care about this community and that you are responsible for keeping WJCT on the air, Jacksonville's public media company. So please, again, give us a call, 904-353-9528. You can also call 1-800-722-9528, or you can give online at WJCT.org. Every dollar helps. And thank you very much for your support.
Welcome back. Well, WJXT Channel 4, our news partner, will air a special presentation tonight at 8 o'clock. 96 Hours of Anguish, is a documentary looking at the destruction in the Bahamas caused by Hurricane Dorian. WJXT's Vic Micolucci and photojournalist Jesse Hansen spent 4 days on the ground there and in the air covering the disaster, documenting the devastation, search and rescue and relief effort. This eye-opening film features Bahamians who are struggling to survive and Florida-based volunteers working to bring supplies into these hard-to-access islands. Here's one excerpt.
We had done a drop again up to Foxtown at one of the farthest points in the North Abacos. And while we were unloading, a truck just pulled right in frantically. A gentleman jumped out and talked to one of our medic corps guys, Lawson, and made him aware that his grandchildren were stranded up the road near a washed out bridge and that he needed help rescuing them. He said 10, 6, and 3. And we've discovered a bridge that was completely washed out from the storm. And there stood the three girls on one side of the road, just hovered together, and their parents on the complete opposite side of the washed out road, just waving their hands frantically.
Again, that is 96 Hours of Anguish, airing tonight at 8 on WJXT Channel 4. The North Florida TPO is in the final stages of updating its long-range transportation plan for this area. It's called Path Forward 2045. Now, you can learn all about this at an open house happening this Thursday evening right here at WJCT Studios. Marcy Larson of North Florida TPO and project manager Wiley Page of Atkins are here now with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Let me also disclose North Florida TPO is a sponsor of this program. And tell us a little bit about this Path Forward 2045 plan, Marcy. This is a long-range look at transportation for the whole First Coast, right?
Yes, it's for the entire region. So Clay, Duval, St. John's, and Nassau counties. And this is a project that we do every 5 years. And so it takes about 2 years. And during the process, we look at not only road building, but bicycle, pedestrian. We look at technology. We look at the influence of freight. Always about moving, how can we better move people and products through our region? And so we are coming to the close of it. It will be approved by our board at the November meeting. So as we go about the process, it's usually about 2 years. We always look for opportunities for public input.
And so this is the public's chance, Wiley, to give that input, to see what's being planned and weigh in and have a say in how this whole region's transportation grid knits together.
That's right. It all will need to work together. We have almost $2 billion or $4 billion, excuse me, in needs and only less than 25% of that revenue to meet those needs. So it'll be really important that we hear from people and what their priorities are and how should we spend the limited resources that we have.
Right. And so I would think, too, there will be a fair bit of discussion about how to improve public transportation, options for cyclists. There's going to be more and more of a push to get more cars off the roads in the coming years. We are a car-dependent city. Is that going to come up at all tonight?
Absolutely. And one of the other more interesting things that will likely come up is automated vehicles and electric vehicles. How will those impact the way we travel? So maybe we're not going to get more cars off the road.
Maybe they'll be driverless.
They may be driverless. And how do we deal with that? So that's a big part of the technology element of the plan.
And that's still in the early stages, Marcy, but what we are seeing about it is exciting as the North Florida TPO, that's Transportation Planning Organization, figures this out. You've shown some renderings and some early plans. Can you paint a picture for listeners out there 20 years from now, 25 years from now, in the year 2045, because that's the target you're shooting for, what is the transportation grid going to look like in this community?
Well, part of what we're doing is through our Smart North Florida program. And coming soon will be an innovation corridor, which will be on Bay Street. And a lot of this technology will come into play there in terms of real life use, if you will. And getting back to the LRTP, it's extremely important that people understand the role of technology, and particularly in the last 5 or 10 years as we've gone about doing the long-range update, technology has started to play a much more significant role. And so through Smart North Florida and just the continuation of LRTP, then we're going to see a lot more in this arena, as Wiley mentioned, automated vehicles. I mean, it's a conversation onto itself. So it's all coming.
When people think about automated vehicles, they seem, Wiley, to have a combination of being both excited and terrified.
Rightfully so,
yeah.
I think. Yeah,
so are you going to bring that up Thursday night?
Well, there's a lot of unknowns of how these vehicles will operate. I think that the technology changes. I've equated this to the change of when we went from a horse and buggy to an automobile, and that's really the magnitude of the change that is on the horizon here. Many, many more questions and unknowns than answers in this arena, and I think the progress that technology is making is just astounding in this regard.
And you have to somehow plan ahead for a future transportation network that incorporates this big leap forward,
yes,
without knowing a whole lot yet about how it's logistically going to work. Yes. I would think it'd be... That's a big lift.
It's a big challenge. It's exciting. You know, the changes that are coming to the curb, for example, where we're not going to have to park there anymore. So maybe that's space, especially in the downtown area, that can be reused.
No, say that again.
The curb.
Why would we not have to park at the curb anymore?
Well, the one of the theories behind automated vehicles is that once it drops you off, it may go pick somebody else up. It may go back home. It may go park itself. So the parking garages, for example, are we going to need those to the level that we have now? Maybe they need to be reused into something else. So there's lots and lots of questions. And certainly the biggest one that we hear is safety. How will the and that is a legitimate concern and certainly something that the industry is still working through.
Sure. People are scared to take their hands off the wheel.
Well, and just talking a little more about safety, not only as it applies to the automated world, but also just in all of the studies and programs that we initiate, safety is always a major concern. It's obviously very high within the Department of Transportation. Another aspect that we're going to be taking a more careful look at this year is the resiliency and how does all of that play into the transportation network. Because we certainly know that as we have these weather situations and other things, that being able to move things through an established and still in place network obviously helps with recovery.
That's right. With more heat waves, more severe weather predicted, sea level rise, as transportation experts, you have to be mindful of that too.
Right, right.
That's a big piece of it as well.
Yes.
Okay, so with all of that said, you want the public to come out this Thursday night starting at 6 p.m., a big free event, a big open house here at WJCT Studios to speak out and give your opinions and feedback about how the transportation network in this community works and what you'd like to see put in place in the coming years. You can go to the website pathforward2045.com. That's pathforward2045.com. Or just show up here 6 o'clock Thursday night to WJCT. Come on in. It's free. And you can be part of this important open house. There are so many people out there that engage with us on the show about transportation issues, so I'm sure you'll get a big crowd. And thank you so much, Marcy Larson with North Florida TPO and project manager Wiley Page of Atkins. Again, that website, pathforward2045.com, 6 p.m. tonight at WJCT. Or Thursday night. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a moment, this week's big country music concert at Daly's Place benefits a very special cause, our local kids. That's next.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. This season, we're celebrating the 250th birthday of perhaps the most transformative composer in all of music history, Ludwig van Beethoven. We're beginning our masterwork season with his unique symphony, The Pastoral. Beethoven said, "No one can love the country as I do," and the beautiful Pastoral Symphony provides the proof. Join us October 4th and 5th. Tickets and more at jackssymphony.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Ta-Nehisi Coates. After writing three nonfiction books dealing with race and identity, and writing new Black Panther comics for Marvel, and writing a much-talked-about article about reparations, he's written his first novel. Set in slave times, it reimagines leaders of the Underground Railroad as having a magical power to help people out of slavery. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Next time on The World, we're in New York at a forum for young entrepreneurs. It's sponsored by a UN organization and a charity that's funded by Saudi Arabia. The event almost didn't happen. The host, the New York Public Library, pulled the plug over concerns about Saudi Arabia's human rights record. Controversy on the sidelines at the UN General Assembly, it's on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Jackson invites you to an evening all about food on October 2nd. Pensacola developer Quint Studer will share how food can be an essential ingredient in revitalizing cities. Then moderator Karen Strybeck will explore the local scene with Downtown Investment Authority CEO Lori Boyer and others. Reserve your free ticket for Setting the Table for Urban Revitalization at wjct.org/events.
I know who you're talking to. And is that bad boy? Is that wrong side of the track?
Welcome back. Well, this Friday, country music superstar Brantley Gilbert performs at Daly's Place downtown. Now, this is the first concert at that venue that's partnering up with the Daly's Foundation to benefit local charities, and that includes local children's hospitals. Right now, we're pleased to welcome Aubrey Edge, President, CEO of Daly's, Chad Johnson, he's Chief Content Officer, Senior VP with the Jacksonville Jaguars, and three-year-old Caleb Musselwhite of Callahan. He's been successfully treated at Nemours for neuroblastoma, and Nemours is one of the beneficiaries of this cool event. Hey, everybody. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi there. Great to be here.
Good to see you. And Caleb, hi, good morning. How you doing, buddy?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. It's so exciting to have you on the show this morning. Now, you were treated at Nemours when you were sick with neuroblastoma, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And they made you better.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
I don't know.
You don't know? Mm-hmm. Well, your dad's here, and I know he feels really good about it. Yeah, and so Caleb, you're such a cutie pie, and it's so exciting for me as a mom to see your happy, healthy face here, knowing that Nemours took care of you. Mm-hmm. So, gentlemen, this is exciting news because there's a big concert at Daly's Place Friday night, and the Daly's Foundation is using this event to support local charities, especially children's-related ones. Can you tell us how this all came together?
Sure. Well, Daly's has given $4 million back to local charities over the past 10 years. But this charity event is a way for us to do something even bigger and better. And that's what we want to do. We want to live up to our tagline of it's nicer here. And the charities we've chosen to celebrate are wonderful charities that do wonderful things in the community. Nemours treats over 80,000 kids every year in Northeast Florida. St. Vincent's Mobile Health Ministry helps underprivileged children and families throughout the area. And then Canines for Warriors obviously treats our servicemen and women who've been injured protecting our country. And those are wonderful charities staffed by wonderful people doing great things in our communities. And we're just blessed to be able to be a part of it.
And so lots of money going in support, as you said, to everybody ranging from St. Vincent's to the Jacksonville School for Autism, the J-Fund, many other groups. And this is a way for people to come out to Daly's Place, to the football stadium, enjoy some music, right? And benefit kids like Caleb, who's now in remission. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Daly's Place is a world-class facility, and the It's Nicer Here theme, you know, really goes throughout. But this was really the vision of Aubrey of being able to have a first-of-its-kind event where every single dollar is going back to these local charities. If you buy a hot dog, if you stop at the Daly's convenience store that's inside the building, or you buy a ticket, every cent is going back to these local charities. We had to find an artist that was willing to help support us, and Brantley's been great. We had Aubrey's bullish vision to make sure we execute it. And where else can you go out, have a great time, have a great party, and know you're making a big impact in the community?
Sure. How much are you hoping to raise Friday night?
Well, I'll let Aubrey comment on that, but I think it's significant.
A lot.
The verdict's out yet, but we're very optimistic that it's going to be very substantive, and I think the charities will all be very pleased.
Now, Caleb, from what I've been told, after you were diagnosed, you had surgery, you've had some rehab. They were worried you wouldn't be able to walk again. Now you're running all over the place. That's pretty cool, huh? Yeah. So are you going to go to the show?
Mm-hmm.
You excited about the show?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you like country music?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think of Brantley Gilbert performing to help kids?
No, no.
You don't know.
Caleb likes Legos. We determined that earlier.
Well, you know what? I'll let you get back to playing with the Legos out in the green room. I don't know if you brought them with you, but I so appreciate you coming in, Caleb. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thank you, Aubrey Edge, President and CEO of Dailies, Chad Johnson, Chief Content Officer, Senior VP with the Jacksonville Jaguars. So again, this is the first ever concert of its kind at Dailies Place. It will benefit directly local charities through Dailies Foundation. It's the Brantley Gilbert concert Friday night at Dailies Place. Guys, great job helping the community, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we hope to be here next year for the second annual Dailies Charity Foundation event.
Okay, and that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. On tomorrow's program, families will speak out about the problems they're having with Florida's Medicaid waiver. That's tomorrow. Make sure to pledge all day, speaking of raising money, to WJCT. We're in the middle of our fall funding drive. You can join us at WJCT.org and donate to this nonprofit organization. I'm Melissa Ross. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Our director is Michelle Corum. Jessica Palumbo is station news director, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
You depend on WJCT. It's a big part of your daily routine. WJTC is your wake-up call, your travel buddy, and your consistent source of unbiased reporting. Solid journalism comes at a cost. Our contributing listeners provide the largest share of our funding. Your support makes it possible for you to hear programs without commercial interruption. Keep WJCT on the air for years to come. Call 904-353-9528 or give online at WJCT.org. And thank you for your support.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.